following tenets and maxims to basically, you know, be on the good book and be on the good list. And you're aware of whether or not you're on that list, and so is God. Well, you're presumably aware
of following the rules. It's interesting because it's worth sort of comparing these, like, we should call these, like, negative religious ethics. So, like, these, you know, thou shalt nots and stuff like that. It's worth comparing them to, like, earlier, you know, like, the way that those might manifest in something like a pagan, like, situation. And again, I'm thinking back to, Odysseus, when he basically does do a thing he shouldn't have done. And that is when he, this is the thing, is like, it's not, there isn't really like a thou shalt not in these pagan religions, but in the Odyssey, he blinds Polemarchus, the one, you know, the Cyclops, who is Poseidon, who is Poseidon's son. So that's no bueno, but he could have gotten away with it had he not boasted his name, right? So there is this ambiguity of like, okay, well, he's being a super badass, which is good, but at the same time, it's not as if this was really a transgression, because he could have gotten away with it. What's wrong there is not sin, but hubris, right?
Yeah, and sin becomes universal. I think that's an important, but like conception, right? Is that like now if we're talking about the ontology that like these edicts and this sort of system is living in, is like God is everything and everywhere, right? Like you can't trick a God. You can't get away with breaking a rule, right? Like God knows all. And I do also want to point out, it says, do not practice magic, do not practice witchcraft. That's a translation, I'm sure, that has more relationship with do not practice like pagan activities and pagan, forms of not witchcraft would be weird, but there's other, you know, sorcery or whatever you want to call it, divinations and stuff. Exactly, right? And so again, this is also an interesting thing of how, you know, you're basically seeing a small and community internalizing on itself and making clear that they are separate from everyone else and have their own, you know, rules and systems. And there's a hard line in like not participating in anything else, right? There is no fluidity here. Like you can't go to the church on Sunday and then go to the temple of Zeus on a Wednesday, right? And give an offering. If you're doing that, like you're out, right? Like, and again, this is a totally different relationship to, you know, the divine, where, because they're in most, you know, in the Roman world, there was a much greater level of acceptance and fluidity in terms of what a person's relationship would be like with gods. And in fact, the Romans even like to kind of collect gods, in the sense of like you conquer a new area, you incorporate that god into your pantheon, you know, and you know that's that god is now a part of like the Roman system, and like you can, you know, it's all part of one, you know, it's fluid, it's open, it's accepting in its own kind of way. And it's considerably less personal. And here it's very personal and insular and not accepting. It's deeply monotheistic. There's another one too that I think is really interesting, which is so if we jump down to 2.5, your speech should not be false nor empty, but fulfilled by action. Actually, sorry, I wanted 2.4 first. You should not be double-minded or double-tongued, for double-tongued is a deadly snare. Basically, no lying and no double-thinking, what we're talking about. So again, there's this internalization of oneself. There's an internalization of one's conscience. What you think about is important. Again, this is not something that's important in the pagan and Homeric traditions, particularly what you're thinking about. And lying, like, nobody really cares comfortable with lying. Like characters in these things lie all the time, as long as like, you know, the lying is part of the process of getting to great honors and, you know, great success and all these sorts of things, right? So the fact now that lying itself is a sin, right? And not only can you lie, like literally be double-tongued and say one thing when you mean the other, or when you know the other, but you can also lie like internally. You can have guilt. Again, this conception of guilt comes up, which is kind of like a new thing in a way. There's another one that I think was very interesting, which is relating to our Roman friends, the Roman world, where we go to 2.5. Your speech should not be false nor empty, but fulfilled by action. I think that this is an attack on rhetoric. Basically that, you know, as you and I, and I'm sure many of our listeners know rhetoric, that, you know, the flourishing and the capacity for aesthetically pleasing speech, especially in relationship with arguments, was deeply, deeply important in the Roman world. This is a rejection of that, of this. Your speech should not be false nor empty. I think specifically the empty part, but fulfilled by action, is basically saying don't use fancy language and fancy arguments or whatever you want to call it, or fancy speeches like the Romans do. It's very common for them to do. This is like teaching rhetoric was, you know, a totally standard thing for an upper class Roman. This is a rejection of that as a value. Again, like being able to have aesthetically pleasing talking abilities, if you want to call it that, is like in some way duplicitous.
I don't know if this is like a real thing. I don't know if anyone else has ever noticed. I'm sure this is a thing that people have noticed, but I've always, when I've like read biblical texts or Christian texts like this, there's always been a kind of monotony about them. There's this like flatline tone about them that I think is maybe present, not just because it's like old and people hadn't invented, you know, interesting words yet. But if you look at, you know, like the plays of the time or any philosophy or anything like that, it's like, sure, it's dry, but it's not like, it doesn't have that biblical monotone.
No, I mean, like Plato's Symposium is a far more fun an interesting read than this, even for our listeners, or anything that you'd find in the Bible. I think you're absolutely right.
Yeah, but this is like the institutionalizing of that. Like when you write in your capacity as like a Christian, write in this like plain way, right?
Yes. Yeah. Say exactly what you mean, because anything else, in some sense, a form of dishonesty, you know, or a form of self-aggrandizement, which again is a complete rejection. It simply says, my child, flee evil. And then 3.1, my child, flee evil of all kinds and everything like it. Again, this is this sort of like pacified, you could call slave morality, like fear morality, where in the pagan world, you know, if there was something that was seen as evil, or, you know, would need to just, you know, the ideal would be to go and destroy that, or to fight it, or whatever it might be, right? This is like an opportunity for a hero's journey of some kind. Now, here, it's simply to flee, to avoid, right? Like, evils are something that are not to be conquered necessarily, but are to be avoided through living well and living with Christians and avoiding heathens, essentially.
There is something sort of ambiguous or gray about pre-Christian, or like in light of pre-Christian religious and ethical conceptions, there's something ambiguous about ethical life in a pagan world, right? Like, again, let's think about Polemarchus, the Cyclops that Odysseus blinds. Is he really a bad guy if you think about it? He's a kind of an ogre. He's a monster, I guess. But Odysseus and his crew kind of, you know, they show up on his island and they know he's hostile, but they still go out, right? So in their kind of religious conception, there is room for questioning conceptions of evil. Like, is Polemarchus really as bad a guy as we think, right? I mean, he's just like, he's a monster. Sure, he eats humans, but maybe that's just what they do. Maybe Odysseus, and again, it's like noble because Odysseus is, he's, you know, he's the xenophile. He loves to go out and meet people and get to know them, and he wants to learn about the world, but he's kind of putting his crew in danger and stuff like that. So again, it's like the pagan world is a very morally ambiguous world, whereas in the Christian conception, it's like there is evil and it is sin which leads to death, and you want to avoid that.
Yes, you need to avoid death at all costs. 3.4, my child, don't observe omens since it leads to idolatry. So again, this is about not observing any other gods. Don't be an enchanter or astrologer or a purifier or be willing to see or hear about these things, for these all lead to idolatry. So this is also, I think, another really important part of like what's kind of encapsulated in the Christian religion. Again, this text is very early. So this is a nascent Christian church, the nascent Christian movement. But already, like, the ideal is to have everyone else pushed out. This is an ethical system that is very strict in the sense of there is only one right way. And that, like, as you were saying, like, the pagan world, this is very ambiguous. You know, like, you know, there's many possibilities, and, you know, in the pagan world, there's many gods. Whereas with the Christian world, there's this simplicity. We have the right way. It's the only way. Flee if you have to now, but also too, like, don't be involved with anyone who has anything to do with anything that isn't going to be considered like good or Christian, you know, because this will lead you away. And in a sense, it's what you have as like the first anti-religion religion, where it's against all other religions and spiritual forms that aren't itself.
Going up back to 2.7, hate no one, correct some, pray for others, and some you should love more than your own life. The point here, I'm bringing us back up to this, to say correct some, pray for others. So you still do have like a relationship, but the relationship is not one of sort of dialogue or exchange in that way. It's more of, are they on the inside or are they on the outside? If they're on the outside, do what you can to bring them on.
3.7 says, on the contrary, be gentle, since the gentle will inherit the earth. I just wanted to point this one out because this is interesting within the context of learning about early Christianity, because this is actually a variation of what you see in Matthew in the Synoptic Gospels we were talking about early on, where it's blessed are the meek, for they will inherit the earth. So this is just more of an actual note of religious studies, where you sort of see, you'll see similar lines and similar formations in texts from the similar eras. And it's kind of like you end up asking who's borrowing from who, but it's also what you're kind of implying from that is that there's this active world of thought and text production going on at this time, where people are copying each other, where people are talking to each other, where people are writing things down. And in many cases, they are going to be very similar because similar ideas are passing around. So, you know, blessed be the meek in this way, since the gentle will inherit the earth, again, is Matthew 5:5. It's almost the same line. It's just interesting how you see this kind of crossover of these very early texts. Like, this is a small community that's trying to grow, and so they're sharing, you know, different ideas and different texts. And you literally see that in front of you in another early piece. So if you jump to 5.1, it goes the way of death. So there was a way of life and the way of death, right? The way of death, on the other hand, is this. It is evil and accursed. Murderers, adulterers, lust, illicit sex, theft, idolaters, magic artists, sorcerers, robberies, false testimonials, hypocrisy, double-heartedness, deceit, haughtiness, depravity, self-will, greediness, filthy talk, jealousy, overconfidence, loftiness, boastfulness, those who do not fear God. The way of death is the way of those who persecute the good, hate the truth, love lies, and do not understand the reward of righteousness. They do not cleave to good or righteous judgment. They do not watch for what is good, but for what is evil. They are strangers to meekness and patience, loving vanities, pursuing revenge without piety for needy and oppressed. They do not know their creator. They are murderers of children, destroyers of God's image. They turn away from those who are in need, making matters worse for those who are in distress. They are advocates for the rich, unjust for judges of the poor. In a word, the way of death is full of those who are steeped in sin. Be delivered, children, from all of this. Obviously, this is a huge list of thou shalt nots, again, basically. But it's also an attack, a very polemic attack, on basically the current hierarchy that this religious structure is living in, because it's an assault on those with power, or those with wealth, those with influence, and basically saying that these are also all evil people, right? So again, this is a reflection of, this is a religion for people who are not the heads of state, who are not consuls of provinces, who are not, you know, leading legions, who are not part of the Roman elite, who are not philosophers in schools, you know, they're not, you know, judges in the system, they're not from, you know, from great and noble families. This is a religion and an ethical system that's clearly being advocated for and by the outsiders of society, right? You know, the bottom 90% of people at the time. And they're basically saying that all these things that we ostensibly think are good about, you know, that these other people have, that the top 10% of society or whoever it's going to be have, these are actually evils. And these evils are going to lead to their imminent destruction. But if you, you know, join the cause, join the religion, then you'll have eternal life and turn away from all of that. And I think that it's interesting, in a sense, almost kind of like a political attack on, you know, the elite of their time when this was written, again, in the first or very early century AD at the height of the Roman Empire.
Yeah. Yeah, it is interesting. I mean, the specific kind of like class dynamics here of, and it's interesting too, you're right to say that this is a religion for, you know, for the majority of the people. Again, to kind of bring up Nietzsche, the Christianity here is like kind of Platonism for the masses, that it is this ethereal kind of idealism made palatable for most people.
Most people who lived in the Roman world at this time, at the height of the Roman Empire, you know, lived in abject poverty, right? And so it makes sense that this sort of religious movement spread and, you know, had converts, because it speaks, again, in a way that, you know, the Homeric traditions don't, right? The Homeric traditions sort of leave you, you know, wishing you were Odysseus, but this religion is actually for you, right? Like this, you're like, you know, you can be, you know, one of the chosen ones. You can be, you know, on the right side of things. You know, God is here for you. Don't let, you know, the temptations of the good life lead you astray. I want to move to the end. So there's some other parts of the text we'll kind of skip over. That really go into, they're more, you know, practical aspects about, you know, how to do things like the Eucharist and how to do things like, you know, like meals, procedural things from the time, which are interesting in and of themselves. But I want to first jump to 15.1 and say, where it says, appointment of bishops for yourselves as well as deacons, worthy of the Lord, of meek disposition and attached to money, truthful and proven, for they also render you the service of prophets and teachers. So first of all, this is interesting because along with the ethical system that's coming along with this, there's also an institutional system that's being brought about, right? So the appointment of bishops, of deacons, of priests, the Christians were going around and establishing churches. They were establishing an actual infrastructure that went along with this ethical, moral system and, you know, ontological worldview, and were establishing it with a kind of universality, or at least we're trying to, that was again in opposition to the kind of pagan world where people sort of like kind of did their own sort of thing with like the god, you know, depending on your specific areas. Well, again, here, like this was, this text itself was translated into many different languages through this era, because consistency in this rule-based religions and ethical system was important, and you couldn't have different rules in different places, and you needed to have, you know, succinct and universal institutions that you could replicate as the system grew.
It wouldn't make sense for this text to sort of survive and function the way it did if it didn't institute its own durability, right? By talking about how to establish churches and how to establish the people to run them, and even maybe the promulgation of the text itself.
This is actually is a heretical text. This isn't in canon anymore, even though it's one of the earliest Christian texts out there. But I wanted to jump down to section 16. This is the end. We can read through parts of it. I think it's more interesting just to talk generally about what's going on in this section. This is an apocalyptic section. So for like our listeners that don't know, apocalypticism is a big topic in early Christianity. And there's a lot of scholars that think that Jesus himself was actually an apocalypticist. Basically, these are people who believe that the end times are coming soon, right? That the judgment day is around the corner. And there's a lot of people, like I said, that Jesus actually in his own time was going around preaching that, like, in his own lifetime, the world was going to come to an end, et cetera, right? Apocalypticism was really popular in early Christianity. And the last section basically talks about how the world is coming to an end very soon. This has deep implications for any moral or ethical system that you're trying to instantiate on any kind of public, if basically everything is about how you're going to be judged, both by your own deeds and the thoughts that you even have, and that judgment is coming soon, and it's a total judgment that involves basically an apocalypse of some kind, then you're going to be really, really zealous and motivated to act in the right ways. I think it's obviously it's part of the doctrine, but it also serves a functional purpose of basically motivating people to be one, to have some kind of hope that like look like in my lifetime, like I'm going to be, you know, like look at all these like rich Roman people or whoever or whatever it might be, or but you know, my day is coming soon. But also like I better spread the good word, I better behave properly, I better help setting up the church, I better go proselyze in the next town and try and convert people, because like it might be next week or it might be in a month from now, it might be in a year, but like pretty soon like the judgment is going to come down, and it's like, you know, my coins are going to be counted effectively. And I think it's a really important part of how this early religion propagated itself and had so much sort of like steam and energy, right? If part of it is the end of the world, then it's like this is a big motivating factor.
Yeah, especially considering that, I mean, because again, like this is it's a system that comes down in two ways. You either live the way of life or the way of death. And that death is closer than you think, right? That thing that you really truly want to avoid, it could be at any, you know, it could be right around the corner. Reading, watch over your life, that your lamps are never quenched and that your loins are never lucid. Be ready, for you do not know on what day your Lord is coming, right? So it's not just that the judgment is sort of being internalized or anything like that. I think that that is true. That like something like an interiority or like an interior subject is forming, but it's just straight up kind of almost not like threats in a way, but these prophesized ways of going about making death far more imminent, right? And that one has to actually enact these things.
At 16.5, he says, then humankind will enter into the fire of trial, and many will be made to stumble, and many will perish. But those who endure in their faith will be saved from under the curse itself. Yeah, so again, it's, you know, the world is going to come to some kind of end, and you, like, and it's going to be a trial by fire. It's not going to be good. But if you're, you know, if your faith is endured, if you're a proper Christian, then, you know, then you're going to be saved, and it's all going to be worth, it's all going to be worthwhile. And I think it's just, it's a really interesting aspect. And you see this a lot in really early Christian movements, this kind of apocalypticism. And it's something that kind of got, like, washed out a little bit within, like, the proper canon. Because, you know, like, centuries go go by, and I think it sort of loses steam a little bit. But very early on, like, again, like, the kind of, as we close out, like, we're dealing with a text where, like, the people who are writing this very well might have met one of the 12 apostles, might have, they may have actually been, you know, as a child, they might have seen, you know, Jesus doing whatever he was doing, or met him proselytizing. So this, you know, this idea that, like, all of this stuff is happening, that it's a world in which, like, time is speeding up effectively, right? Like, you're seeing the shift in temporality. The pagan world, temporality is kind of in this form of stasis, right? Like, it's not really going anywhere. The world has been formed. The gods are doing their thing. They're toying with humanity and having fun. But there's no projection to any sort of, like, particular point, whereas you're now introducing this temporal aspect, and you're introducing, you know, an ethics which hinges on this temporal aspect. There's a ticking clock to your, how well you behave and how well you follow.
Yeah, I don't know if we've talked about it on the show before. I think we have, but this comparison and contrast between the temporality of these pagan religions to the introduction of basically rectilinear time, right? So before, in the pagan religions, it was cyclical, because the gods and goddesses essentially stood for natural features, and those features cycle, right? But with the introduction of Christianity, you have something like a historical god who actually is not just a cyclical recurring thing, but is actually standing for events that happen, right? Things happen. Yeah,
there's a plan. And there's a process, and there's a story that's unfolding. And, like, you need to be ethical, you know, you need to be an ethical individual to be part of that. But it's interesting, because to kind of end the show, it's also an ethic. This is, like, the kind of standard criticism of Christian ethics. It certainly is different from the ethical systems of, say, Aristotle and, you know, virtue ethics, as we call it, you know, today, or even Stoicism, where, you know, it's this, and it's this internal improvement of oneself to live, of living the good life, or whatever that looks like, you know, in itself is the worthwhile exercise, in itself is, you know, the reason for, you know, being virtuous is its own reason for being virtuous, right? Effectively, there's a punishment and reward system. You're being good, you want to be on God's side, because if you're not, then you're on the path of death, and you don't want to be on the path of death, so you need to follow the rules. And again, it's this kind of, like, external motivation through the system, through this rule system, that makes, you know, the ethics, you know, worthwhile and gives them value. But they only have value in so much as God has made them their edict, apparently. But with that, it's been a really interesting show, and it's always interesting to jump into these really ancient and kind of esoteric texts. And we hope that you've enjoyed listening to the Canadian Philosophy Show.
You can find the Canadian Philosophy Show at tcps.podbean.com and on Apple Podcasts and Spotify.
You are listening to CJSF 90.1 FM, SFU Burnaby.
With 1.5 million Canadians identifying as blind or having low vision, what will the future look like as we move to a world where using our eyes for screen time is at an all-time high? The BC Yukon Division of the Canadian Council of the Blind, or CCB, is a group run by the blind for the blind, where sports and recreation, technology training, and peer support are just a few of what they offer. To find out more, visit ccbbcyukon.com.